Hello and welcome to the Horse Geeks podcast, where we look at horses and riders from the inside out. I'm Kirsten Nelson, professional horse trainer, developer of Training for Optimal Balance. And with me again is Deb Romero. I always stumble on how to introduce you. Certified Alexander Technique instructor and also orthopedic massage therapist and developer of Optimal Posture. So today's topic is going to be on what's called umwelt. Well, Americans say it umwelt, U-M-W-E-L-T. It's developed by a German scientist, so probably pronounced umwelt. But it describes how various species perceive through their five senses. And we're going to go over a paper by Carol Saslow, S-A-S-L-O-W, titled Understanding the Perceptual World of Horses. So Deb and I have read this paper. We're just going to kind of throw out our thoughts and how that relates to horses and riders. And before we tuck into that, this is our 12th podcast. And I just wanted to reiterate sort of the purpose and the intention behind even doing this podcast that Deb has so graciously
twisted my arm.
You know, these podcasts are unscripted. I'm sure you can tell sometimes. Deb and I having a lot in common professionally and being friends and working off of similar theories that the central nervous system is what dictates the movement and the habits of movement of the body. That's what we really have in common between the training I do with horses and what she does as an Alexander Technique instructor. But what I find in working with, I work primarily in rehab. So dealing with behavioral issues, lameness issues, getting young horses started under saddle or solving different performance problems, what kept showing up in my training evolution or evolution as a rider was that so many of these problems could be pulled back to what was going on internally between the horse and the rider, that the thoughts and the emotions or the emotional state and the physical coordination that we describe as correct biomechanics or balance or collection or whatever term you want to use, that physical, mental, and emotional internal world was really where I learned to find the solutions to a whole variety of problems. And it's what we all have in common, whether we're all humans as riders or all equines, because I work across breeds, ages, different, you know, types of performance as the goal, whether it's racing or jumping, dressage, Western riding, trail riding. Like none of that matters as much as what's going on internally. And that was how we came up with our sort of tagline for the podcast of looking at horses and riders from the inside out. Because my intention, I feel when we shift paradigms, just take a fresh look at the same old problems. When we can shift our perspective and we, instead of looking at what the horse is doing or not doing, which is the external manifestation of what's going on internally, we could go deeper and look internally at the emotional state, the thoughts, the direction of thoughts, the mental focus, or the physical use and coordination of the body, and just changing my perspective to look at things that way led to a lot of success getting, you know, turnarounds with problem horses or lame horses. So with you joining me, Deb, what would you say for your biggest intentions are for doing this podcast?
Just really exploring and sharing the depth of information we both have, and that I completely agree that, you know, being that I was a body worker or a massage therapist for at least 10 or 15 years, I could fix people on the table, But as soon as they got up and went into their own, their world, all of their habits come back. And that's when I was introduced to the Alexander technique, because the Alexander technique helps the human to change from the inside out. So we're kind of doing the same thing. You just work more with horses, and I work more with people and riders. So the combo I like is great, because a lot of the things that you see in horses, we see in people.
And I would say it's shockingly similar.
Shockingly similar is a good way to put it. Yes, yes.
Because when it comes to that interaction of the sort of mind-body connection, you can't be lame and fully capable of a balanced mental-emotional state. Like, one affects the other.
That is so true. Especially if you ever, as riders, we usually have a painful event.
Yes. Definitely colors our experience going forward. It changes. If we have a painful physical event, it affects us with how we feel and what we think about on the next.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I just love, we've always loved brainstorming together. We've always, you know, what about this? And what about that? And so that's another one of the main reasons, intentions, is that I just enjoy having a conversation with you. So
yes, this is our way of getting together when we can't travel anymore.
And I'm not jumping on a plane, so yes, we can do this.
Yes. And I think as we dive into, like, this particular paper that we're going to talk about is really emphasizing maybe the differences between horses and humans in how they perceive through their five senses. But for a large extent, when we talk about how thoughts affect emotions and emotions affect thoughts, how the coordination and mechanical use of our body affects us mentally and emotionally and vice versa, that is universal across horse bodies as well as human bodies, and or species, we could say. Because, and what that internal experience is very much the same. You know, how we respond to pain, how we respond to pleasure, how, what makes us feel safe, what makes us feel unsafe, what makes us feel stable, what makes us feel unstable. All of those experiences that are internal, we can relate to and develop a very deep compassion for the horse. That we go, okay, maybe we're not scared of that plastic bag, but we're scared of something else, so we can know what that feels like and try to help them through it, rather than go, you idiot, you know, it's just a plastic bag.
Why are you afraid of that? Well, I learned a lot from reading this article. I mean, I knew some of this stuff, but I wasn't, this kind of fine-tuned it and gave you, you know, exactness of the whys. Why are humans, you know, different, and why do horses react or respond in ways that maybe us as humans don't completely appreciate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And right off the bat, and this was one of my sort of goals with even starting this podcast called Horse Geeks, is to look at, because knowledge needs to be shared. And I go, it takes so long to develop any real knowledge with horses. Even if you're raised with them, it is a lifetime of learning and sharing information, especially looking at scientific research that's available to all of us now. I mean, PubMed is an amazing wealth of information. And then going, how does that relate to our daily experience? How does it become useful? So that we're not going off of tradition or what we've learned from whatever mentor who happened to stumble across our path with a horse. It's like we can think farther and we can look at, wow, here's the research on it. How does that relate and how could we do better?
And yeah, so I like that. I think we're both like that. We're both lifelong learners. We're, you know, seekers of information.
Yes. And hopefully by sharing the information we're going to read anyways in a podcast. Hopefully it helps a few other people and horse owners along the way. So the paper again is titled Understanding the Perceptual World of Horses. The author is Carol Saslow, S-A-S-L-O-W. She's with the Psychology Department, Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. So she caught me right off the bat in her abstract that says that some of the challenges of even researching equine perception is, this made me laugh. The first is that the it has huge gaps because this animal is not a convenient laboratory subject. No, really.
I can't carry it in a cage, can we?
Yeah, they're a little bit high maintenance to make laboratory subjects. And then this caught my attention again right off the bat is that the second is that the horse, having been a close companion to humans for many millennia, entrenched anecdotal wisdom is often hard to separate from scientific fact.
That caught my eye too.
Yes, I feel that. Absolutely. And so then she goes on to describe how it's a lot of the tools or methodology we've used to say decipher levels or frequency of hearing in humans. Like, we can't take that same device and just put it on a horse and get the same feedback. So all of these tools that we have developed to measure human eyesight, hearing, sense of touch, sense of taste, sense of smell, a lot of those devices or measuring tools are just not practical to use with other species, not just horses, but yes, particularly horses, because they don't stay in cages very well.
Not the ones I know anyway.
Yes. So anything you want to add before we get into the meat and potatoes of it?
That was the one liner that really piqued my attention, and that, you know, we need to always be searching for the new science. We need to always be testing that in real life with the horses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And some of the findings that she puts in her abstract were equine high frequency hearing extends far above that of a human, but the horse may be less able to localize the point of origin of brief sounds. So they can hear things we can't hear. The horse's capacity for chemoreception and its reliance on chemical information for identification may more closely resemble that of the dog than a human. And then she does go in the paper into the construction of the olfactory system for the horse and how that's related to actual brain development. It's one of the oldest senses of evolution, going from marine life to land life.
Yeah, and that really caught my attention about the nostrils. Do you remember that? That they're two singular type of channels, shall we say. So that just heightens their ability to smell something.
Right. And they point in different directions. So they're gathering information from
this direction instead of us is, you know, right down, and it all goes into the same place.
Right.
So, and I think what really sparked my interest in that was she mentions we need to be very aware of the smells we're emitting.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, you know, that old traditional saying, don't let the horse know you're afraid. It's like, too late. You're already
too late.
Pheromones that the horse can smell a mile away.
Yeah. And they can smell the vet truck coming. They can.
Well, one of my jokes, if I meet a new horse, especially for rehab, some of them will have quite a negative reaction to a new person. And particularly, my joke is that I smell like a trainer. I have no idea what I smell like to the horse, but I go, they know they can recognize sort of an equine professional. I don't know how. Sometimes maybe it's the ball cap, or maybe I doubt it's what we're wearing, but I always joked that I smell like a trainer, but I'm not that bad, is what I tell the horse.
I'm not that bad. And she also mentioned, which I thought, I didn't even take this into context, is that they like familiarity, that like they like their blanket, they like their halter, yes, by smell. So I thought, well, that's, you know, do we ever take the time to properly introduce new things to the horse?
Only if they're scared of it.
Here, get over here.
So Umwelt, let me just mention this because, and I'm doing the American pronunciation, Umwelt. I think it was early in the 20th century, J. Von, and I am going to hatchet this last name, Uexkull, Uexkull, used the term Umwelt to characterize the particular perceptual world of a species. So each species evolves the umwelt, which is really the collection of the five senses, which allows it to extract from the external world the information its ancestors needed for survival. So the senses, in other words, develop specifically for the survival of that specific species, which for the horse, obviously, the smell of a predator is going to be a very different emission of odor than another prey animal. So having that high sensitivity of smell probably helps them easily alert to the scent of a lion or pack of dogs or something that could cause harm to them.
That's a good point, because we are predatory.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's the main thing, the main difference between horses and humans, the crux of the challenge, is dogs and cats we relate to because they are predatory species. The psychology and the umwelts are similar to ours. But horses as a prey animal species are in the category of deer and chicken and, you know, totally different psychology, totally different survival mechanisms. And therein is the rub of a human predator trying to have a healthy relationship with this 1,000-pound prey animal. I go, that, you know, that's where a lot of what seems intuitive to us is counterproductive to a relationship with a prey animal species. And she actually mentions that too. She goes, when we interpret, she goes, it's difficult to shake off one's own species specific perception of reality. When we interpret the actions of our companion animals, we are prone to attribute behavioral shortcomings or peculiarities to a lack of intelligence, quote unquote, and deficit obedience, on the other hand, right?
That's a big one in the horse world.
But she also says, or attribute to the animal extrasensory perception, ESP, right? So it's really, she goes, it's best explained as a mismatch of umwelts, because it's where they can seem like they have ESP and read our thoughts. They're just highly perceptive in certain bodily functions, more so than we are. And I think that's where horse whispering comes from. The sort of myth of horse whispering is that when you're approaching a horse, understanding that their strongest, I think I wrote it down, their strongest senses are in the order of touch, number one, smell, number two, hearing high frequencies, number three, and then vision, number four. And humans were very strong visually, much more so than the horse, but we go, just look at that thing that's scaring you, not understanding that their vision is completely different than
they can't see it.
theater, they don't see it the same way.
Yeah.
So taking them to look at what they're afraid of is pretty futile.
Right.
And I've seen it not work a whole lot.
I've had it not work a whole lot.
Yeah. Also, to think that somehow horses have this magical capacity that we don't have, to sort of put them on the level of, I don't know, ethereal guides. It's like, they have their own things too. Mm-hmm. Like we could say, we're just human. I go, well, they're still horses.
Right.
But learning to tap into that sensitivity is, it is pretty magical. It feels to us like we're communicating on this whole different level, because we're communicating in a range that makes sense to the horse. That's how we have to adapt our nonverbal communication, is to understand smell makes a difference. Sounds make a difference, right?
It can even be what you're thinking and feeling makes a difference, hugely.
Oh, especially if we talk about smell, because you're going to release different hormones, as we talked about, with different thoughts and emotions. Your body is secreting different chemicals, or producing different chemicals, which are being secreted through your sweat, which really are only researched in the context of breeding. But horses, they can literally probably smell fear. In a predator, if you are a prey animal and you smell fear in the predator, that's got to send off every freaking fire alarm in your body.
What's the matter with you?
I'm going to put you on high alert, right?
I think that really being an Alexander teacher and very touch oriented, that is key to me, that they experience a much higher level of intelligence around touch than we tap into. I really think the capability for us to get closer to their level is available to us. But
advancement of the rider.
Yeah. And that, as an Alexander teacher, is, you know, that's the world we live in, of the least amount is better.
The least amount. Nature is efficient. And when we learn to control the mechanics better, we become more efficient, which means we save energy. But when it comes to a horse, we communicate more clearly the more control, self-control we have over our own bodies.
Oh, I like that. The more self-control, and I'd like to add self-aware. You know, where is this unit of my body, and how is it affecting the horse?
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the sense of touch with the horse. And the first thing, I have her paper here, that's why I'm flipping through it and reading my notes. The first thing that caught my attention about the horse's sense of touch was using stimuli developed for gauging human tactile sensitivity. We were surprised to find that the horse sensitivity on the parts of the body which would be in contact with the rider's legs is greater than what has been found for the adult human calf, or even the more sensitive human fingertip. Horses can react to pressures that are too light for the human to feel.
That just blows me away.
That is probably like my favorite paragraph in this entire paper.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've always said if they can feel a fly on the back leg and move that skin to try to get it off, to me, that's really powerful.
Very. But it also explains the fact that one of the highest levels of sensitivity on the horse was basically the barrel where we sit, the legs go. When I thought about that, I mean, if you put that in the context of why would it be that way in through the lens of evolution or survival, the way the herd moves as one unit, is through that sensitivity that isn't reliant on visual. So in other words, how does a flock of birds move as one big motion without crashing into each other? How do horses move as a herd without looking back over their shoulder to see where their buddy is, right? Or to feel when they're running at full gallop, how do they not crash into each other? And of course, somebody out there is raising their hand going, my horses just crashed into each other in the tractor. And I go, okay, that happens. But for the most part, that sensitivity level in the center of the body makes me think of how herd-based survival animals have to know where the rest of their herd is through a sensing mechanism that's faster than looking, right?
Yeah.
And probably is less able to be interrupted by high light, low light that would sort of interrupt visual input or sounds that might interrupt auditory input. It's like that, those little antennas that are on the side of a horse's barrel help them feel where their other herd members are. And yeah. A lot of times, just a simple exercise like hand walking, I go, when the human is in lockstep with the horse's motion, the horses tend to relax and feel safer almost immediately when they're in rhythm with another body, even if it's a human body.
Oh, I like that. In rhythm. Yeah. Playing with actually tuning yourself into their movement instead of the other way around.
Exactly. That can offer a horse an instant sense of stability and safety. And it simulates, it's how we can simulate what happens in a herd environment through their sense of touch. And lockstep is a term, I forget which scientist came up with it, to describe this sort of harmonic frequencies that herds move at, whether it's an elephant herd or gazelles or zebras or horses, that all of the animals within a herd start to move at the same frequency, in the same rhythm to each other. And that is a known herd dynamic. So that sensitivity level on the sides where our legs would hang is probably the mechanism that allows them to do that without being reliant on visual input or auditory input. And then it made me think, it sort of makes my skin crawl to think of that high level of sensitivity and how often we're squeezing horses like a tube of toothpaste between our calves. We're using spurs. I go, so if you took a spur and you used it on your fingertip, the horse's side where the spur would touch is more sensitive than our fingertip. So if we're jabbing a horse with spurs or really being harsh with a whip or even heavy with our legs, I go, that has got to be so overwhelming to a horse.
I wonder, because when you said heavy with the leg, I wonder what gripping does to them. You know, those riders that maybe aren't stable through their spine. And I was taught as a hunter jumper rider to grip with my thighs, you know, grip with your knees when you're going over a jump and things like that. So all of that, I wonder, you know, does it shut them down if they're having that done to them all the time? That they just
either become overreactive or they shut down, because overreaction would be probably the first most natural impulse, but that makes them unsafe to ride. So we can quickly leverage them out of that overreaction.
Oh, we do, don't we?
Mm-hmm. And then it's sort of, you could probably explain this better than I can. What happens to the body when excessive pressure is just maintained on a single body part or a single area of the body? So in other words, if you sit on your foot for too long, it just starts to go numb.
Right. And in between there are, it's kind of like, we've talked about this before, the action before the action. There are signs that happen before that happens.
What do you mean by that?
So if your foot's going numb, there might have been a step before that of a little bit of pain. There's always, and we've talked about this with horses too, before the big blow up over here, there may have been some things going on over here before that, that we could have noticed and redirected and
the more subtle version of the problem.
Yeah, the more subtle thing that's going on. And as an Alexander teacher, that's what we want to get the human to be working on, is that subtleness. What's going on at that inner subtle level that is going to get much larger of a problem if I don't take care of the smaller piece?
Right. And a lot of people will say the horse is dull to the leg, won't listen to the leg. So they start scooching or driving with the seat, or they put on spurs. And really, the spurs, I think, are almost overwhelming. And a whip is actually a better tool to stimulate forward motion in a horse than spurs, because spurs are going to affect the rib cage, where what a whip does without a hard touch, just a light tap, the reason a whip works for forward is because you're gently touching the hindquarter, which, just like if somebody taps you on the shoulder, you focus there. Your brain goes to where somebody touched you. So a whip is a good tool for forward because it's a very light touch that brings the horse's attention to their hindquarter, which is where you want them to initiate forward. But spurs actually were originally invented for more lift, not more forward.
Oh, and that's cool.
Yeah, and still, even with the idea of lift, it's we've learned more how the horse lifts, and it's not from the belly muscles or the bottom of the rib cage. So again, spurs to me, just, I don't see a point to them. And what I do see is, because of this sort of layer of sensitivity that a horse has, they learn to shut off. I think they can disassociate from that part of their body. And most of the times, the reason the horse won't go forward is because they're not comfortable in the forward motion. So they add more leverage or more stimulation, say with spurs or too much leg pressure, they just shut down more. I never see it work. I never see a horse find more self-propelled forward from the use of spurs or too much leg or a driving seat. It's like the reason they're not going forward is much more complex than just getting obedience.
Exactly.
The other thing about the sense of touch that I underlined was how it can be, how we sense or respond to pain. And the part I underlined was, where is it? The intensity of emotional response to pain perception appears to be based in part on circulating neurochemicals. From what we know as of now, it is crucial for behavioral pain management in an animal to increase endorphin release while decreasing activation of the sympathetic nervous system, which we already talked about. Mm-hmm. So I found that interesting. I would have thought that the sympathetic nervous system had almost a pain postponement. But what they're saying here is that in the sympathetic nervous system, pain is heightened. And I'm wondering if that is immediate or long-term.
Yeah, and there were some key words in there that I'm really curious about. It said perception of pain. So pain is a perceived thing.
Right.
So I'm very curious about that.
But how being in the state of fight or flight or in the sympathetic nervous system could likely exacerbate the perception of pain. And the first thing I do when I get in rehab horses, because the behavioral and the lameness are always intimately linked.
Of course. Same thing with people and pain and their behavior.
Yeah.
And their emotional state and what they're thinking, all of that.
So the horse's response, I find, goes one of two ways. They either have pain and become highly self-protective or defensive, and they get labeled as behavioral problems. And then other horses, they don't become as defensive. They just sort of tolerate. They maybe have a higher threshold of pain tolerance, or they're more secure and feel safe within themselves, so they deal with the pain better. But those horses just quietly go lame. And
I've got one of those.
And so a horse that doesn't want to go forward, where we have to, here we know on the one hand, they're highly sensitive. It's like fingertips where our legs go, right? So we can feel lots of things with our fingertips, and we go, okay, the horse felt my leg aid. So why am I not getting forward?
Yep.
Right? That's a bigger issue. And I go, especially, I'll tell people a lot when they call their horse lazy, I go, they're not designed to be lazy. They're designed to be highly efficient movers who evolved by moving an average of 25 miles a day. So why would a horse suddenly not want to go forward? I go, that speaks to a high level of discomfort in motion.
And the rider could be part of that equation.
Absolutely. But adding more discomfort to the problem rarely leads to the solution.
Exactly. And you're saying that added discomfort is the pressure from the rider, whether it's spurs, kicking,
stinging,
whatever.
All kinds of things. Yeah. But adding more discomfort as a negative reinforcement to get forward out of a horse. I go, I never see it actually initiate the impulse to move forward. The horse just waits until the leg aid is off and then they stop. Or they wait for the lack of stimulation and then they have no self-motivated forward or self-regulated forward. And I go, that's unnatural to the species of horses. They survive through movement. So I go, what that speaks to is a level of discomfort in movement that has to be addressed, not just more force. Pushing them to go faster and more forward. I see people do it for years. It still doesn't work. I just go, how's that working for you? there's got to be a better solution where the horse desires to go forward.
Ooh, I like that. The horse desires. Or how about if, we let them be part of the thinking process and maybe they have some ideas that we need to listen to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So touch was a big one.
That was a big one for me too.
And even related to pain, intuitively, horses that are lame are usually a bit defensive, either cranky or highly alert. And horses that have behavioral issues usually have a pain issue lurking in there somewhere. So that whole sort of process of cultivating the learning frame of mind, or taking time to make the work easier so that they can shift out of the sympathetic nervous system and get into the parasympathetic nervous system, that's a huge part of rehab.
That's a great idea you just brought up, because as the human predator that we are as riders, what system are we in when we're approaching the horse? Are we in our own parasympathetic or sympathetic? Are we looking at our watch going, oh my gosh, I've only got an hour?
Yeah.
That kind of mentality.
Today we canter and I only have an hour. Yes.
So, we need to check in too and say, what am I bringing to this equation? Am I bringing a plus energy or a negative energy into the situation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to go back to, we sort of talked about touch. I want to go back to smell a little bit and see if I underlined anything in this paper. Oh yeah, this was something I did not know. The vertebrate cerebral hemispheres developed from the roof of the olfactory lobe. Olfaction was the principal sense that animals coming out on land exploited for distance information. So I go, wow, our nose developed our brain. That's amazing.
Us as predators, or is that that's vertebrates, you said?
Yes, vertebrates.
It's vertebrates. Okay.
Vertebrates. So then it says the limbic system of the mammalian brain, which regulates emotion and motivation, was originally driven primarily by olfactory input. While in primates, and especially humans, olfactory structures have greatly diminished, the horse brain has extremely large olfactory bulbs with a convoluted surface. So just the construction of the horse's olfactory system really tells us, and it's interesting that it ties into the limbic part of the brain, which is also the limbic part of the brain is what fires up when we're in our sympathetic nervous system. So the cognitive part of the brain, or the more evolved part, which is the executive director of the brain, does not light up at the same time as the limbic system. That's like a physical reality of brain research. I'll have to find some research on that.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So when we're in the fight flight instinctual response, which what they're saying in a horse could be triggered by smells.
Well, I can attest to that. When we lived in New Mexico, we had mules and we would pack and go elk hunting. And when my husband had gotten an elk and we had to cut it up out there in the field and pack it, you have to put something in the horse's nostrils.
Yeah.
And we found out the hard way. Our mule took off with a full pack on it. She just kept going. And I went, oh yeah, we forgot that nose thing.
Yeah, the Vicks Vapo rub.
Vicks in the nose. We learned our lesson.
Yeah. And those mules will unpack that pack.
It got tenderized. That's what we...
Yep. That's one of those like, oh yeah, prey, predator.
I forgot that one. Yeah.
Absolutely. So smell that we can't even perceive.
Oh.
We can't even perceive what the horse can possibly smell. So it could be a dead animal, could be a dead body, who knows, right? But it could be all kinds of things that they smell that trigger a fight flight response that it really works in their favor for survival, but maybe works not so much in their favor in the domestic environment. Mm-hmm. Not that you have to go around and put Vicks in your horse's nose.
No.
To consider like out on the trail, because our vision is so strong, especially in daylight, we think the horse is afraid of an old black stump.
Yeah.
Maybe the horse is smelling, I don't know, some poisonous mushroom that's growing inside of that old dead stump. And we have no clue whatsoever what they could be smelling. We just think they see what we see.
Right. And that's not the sense, the sight is not the sense that they are relied on like we are.
It's probably also the sense, because I have horses coming and going in a training barn, but horses that come back, like I have some horses that just live here and my horses, and I'll have certain clients' horses that will come and go. But once they've gotten to know my herd, they come and go without issue. They remember each other very clearly. And
well, that's good to know. That's cool.
Yeah. If that isn't part of their scent or their smell, that they recognize the other horse and just basically say, okay, you're back, without the same introductory drama of a new horse.
Of the first time. Yeah.
So anything else that struck you? Smell, touch, hearing. I just think it's amazing with hearing that they basically can hear much higher frequencies than we can hear, which makes me think of, you know, 4th of July and New Year's, all the fireworks, why they can have such a panic reaction to loud noises.
That's fascinating to me. I have a story around that. So when we lived in a different place, we lived close to the local airport where they had a parachute school. And every weekend, what we would call it, raining people. And our horses would just look up at all these people coming down and landing in our pastures. And my horses don't have a sensitivity to the fireworks. And I'm wondering if that's why. I don't know. But maybe they're just desensitized. I don't know.
Over time, my horses got better and better. But what I did was turn on all the loud fans.
Like a white noise situation,
Overwhelmed some of it. But under hearing, she says, the horse range of hearing may not go down to quite as low frequencies as does the human, but it certainly exceeds the highest frequencies that can be heard by humans, over 33,000 hertz or cycles per second, as compared to a human limit of under 20,000 hertz. So that's 13,000 hertz more than what we can hear.
And I wonder, so I'm thinking when I'm riding and my horse gets distracted is what the word I come up with.
Yes.
And they turn their head. Now that I have all this information, I'm wondering if they're turning their head to hear better, not necessarily see. I'm always looking like, what are you looking at?
That's exactly what they're doing. So what she says in the paper is they can hear these very high frequencies. So, you know, they can hear the predator step on and snap the twig a long way away. They have these sort of cone-shaped ears that can wiggle around 360 degrees almost on top of their head.
That's true.
They can point those ears almost as sound locators. But what they can't locate is accuracy. So it's a generalized high level of hearing without the ability to go, oh, it was that.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that makes a lot of sense because odd sounds, it's like, okay, now we're in our sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight. We're ready.
Again.
But then they might have to hear it for a little while or take time to pinpoint what was making the noise before they go, oh, that's just my human banging around again.
So they got to process it.
Yeah, because they're not quick to geolocate the source of the sound, but they do hear sounds. I would imagine that if you hear higher frequencies, I don't know, it doesn't say in this paper if that translates to also hearing from greater distances.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And it doesn't say. But hearing, again, we think the horse is looking at something. And they're hearing it, or they're smelling it, or they're sensing it, because the sense of touch can also be what we call sensing energy or personal space.
Right.
Not just physical touch. So finally, we get to the eyes. Which what cracked me up is like the very first part of this woman writing this introduction to her paper. She goes, I'm glad I did not have the occasion to look at the histology of the horse's eye until long after I had stopped riding horses at speed over large jumps. Yeah, like most riders, my naive assumption was that horses saw what I saw. And they don't. So what did you get out of anything about the vision of the horse?
I think what is really sticking with me is that they don't see what we see.
Yeah.
At all.
So in other words, if we were to generalize it, what she's saying is that they have a sensitivity to be able to detect what they see in minimal light. So they see very well in dark conditions, but that reduces the acuity or the ability to see the detail in visual pattern, right?
And I think she's mentions it somewhere about, you know, that's a developmental thing of a nocturnal species.
Right.
The dim light thing.
Right. And that, you know, the mark of a prey animal species is the eyes on the side of the head versus a predatory species, which is described by the eyes on the front of the head. So where we have extremely good vision as a predator for using our focal vision to line up the prey and have dinner, horses and all prey animals develop with eyes on the side of their head that is the equivalent to human peripheral vision.
And, you know, that brings up a good point for me when I was reading it is they probably spend more time in the periphery being a prey animal. And when we're riding, we tend to focus on tunnel vision and forget about the periphery that's around us.
No, as natural predators, we overuse our focal vision naturally. And with riders, one of the ways to tap into experiencing through your body more, becoming more aware of how you're using your body or to experience the forces that the horse is generating in motion, I'll have people purposefully shift into their peripheral vision. It
yes.
actually allows you to sense internally easier than when we're using our focal vision, which makes sense because focal vision is to externally hunt prey.
You shut out everything else.
Right.
Yeah.
And peripheral vision opens up the field around you visually. So you don't see detail, but you can more easily sense movement all the way around you in a larger field of vision.
Yeah, I like that piece.
Yeah, and the fact that because, and I think it has to do, like, because they can't do actual, like, you know, eye chart tests like we do for on horses.
F-H-O-P.
You're sort of, you know, saying this based on the anatomy of the horse in sort of the rods versus the cones.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So what else did I underline here about? Yeah, so even people will say, can horses see in color? And you respond well to small contrast fluctuations, but not really color perception or detail perception. So horses may be sort of partially colorblind from our perspective. They see peripherally more than they see binocularly. So they don't see detail. So taking a horse straight up to something it's afraid of, again,
their nose is going crazy. Snort, snort, snort. Can't you see that?
That is a classic umwelt crisscross. Yeah. Can't you see that? Well, no, frankly, my dear, I can't.
I can't, actually.
No, I actually don't see what you see. And when we're guiding a horse over jumps, it's like that horse is very dependent on the skin sensitivity. It's dependent on what that rider is doing with their body that's guiding the motion of the horse, because they don't have super depth perception. They don't have detail perception. They don't have color perception. So like the challenging jumps for horses are the ones with the waving flags, because that's what they see.
And you know, that brings up a really good point, is you've got to be energetically, and you have got to be so organized in your own body at that level of riding, because you can't be saying in your body, are we going to make it? Are we going to get over this jump? Because then the horse is going to sense it and go, I don't know. Are we?
Yeah. Yeah.
You see those bold riders just go out there and do it.
Yes. Or like crossing water. I go, horses see the movement of the water, even a little pool, right? That sometimes they'll put under jumps, just a little like 3-inch pool of water.
Right.
And the horses freak. And I go, so, or a stream crossing or a puddle. Mm-hmm. It's like what they see is the movement of the mm-hmm. water. And it may as well be a freaking black hole in the universe from their perspective. Yeah. No depth perception to go to see how deep it is. They can't see it. So they literally have to trust the guidance mm-hmm. of the rider, which means there is a whole relationship thing behind that.
Huge.
You ask the horse to cross something that they don't visually understand. It might smell funny to them, right? It might, like little streams or brooks might be making sounds that they are unfamiliar. So we go, no, they're perceiving that little simple water crossing in a very different way than we are.
Exactly. I wonder what it would be like if it would be like somebody leading us around with our eyes closed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that's a good simulation to help people really learn to communicate through the.
Here, let's go out for a walk.
Yeah.
Let's go on a trail ride with your eyes closed.
Yeah. I'm going to blindfold you and take you on the trails. Let's see how.
See how well you stay in your parasympathetic with that one.
Yes. And so it just, like, looking at this paper, I recommend people who are really interested in understanding their horse can find this paper. I forget where I got it. It was one of the online, either PubMed or something like that. But really interesting to just look at things through the horse's perspective and go, what makes sense to us doesn't always make sense to a prey animal's psychology or how the horse is perceiving the very same object in front of us or the very same event that just happened or situation. The horse can have a complete alternate reality experience of the same thing. And it's too easy to label them as stupid or disobedient or problematic. Because they can't communicate to us in words what they're experiencing. They have to show us through their behavior. But if we read the behavior, we can easily differentiate between fear and misunderstanding. Like, those are two very different energies. But for the horse to have a simple misunderstanding and us to start leveraging control, trying to make them do it, I go, that can lead to fear. What could have been a simple misunderstanding, if we pounce on them like a predator with our legs, our reins, our seat, it's like, no wonder they overreact. Mm-hmm. Rather than just learning to understand that this is part of being in the human environment and they can handle it.
Yeah.
So I thought Umwelt was super interesting. Anything you want to add?
I just want to read a quote. I think it was at the end. People should be aware of the sound they make, the movements of their body, the way they touch the horse, and the odors they emit or carry on their clothing. End of quote. I think that just sums it up altogether.
That does. And those are the things we're the least aware of.
I agree.
Because all of that, what she's describing, is part of nonverbal communication. Mm-hmm. And what we think we're doing is we laser focus our eyeballs on the horse and go, moots, 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 you want a treat? And then we expect them to do what we want. That's so human of us.
That is so human.
Because it works with a cat or a dog, so we try it on horses.
Yeah.
part of the beauty and really looking at our relationship with horses from the inside out is that for a predator to develop a really healthy, mutually beneficial relationship with a prey animal is a big deal. Like, we kind of take it for granted because horses have been part of the human life for so long. Mm-hmm. I think they've adapted to us far more than we've adapted to them.
I totally agree.
But there's lots of great lessons to be learned in that relationship because it's inherently not set up to work. I think that's why we get called crazy horse people or horse geek. Because we really have to understand it and we have to go beyond instinct. We have to go beyond our predatory instinct to have a relationship with a prey animal. And we're asking our prey animal to go beyond prey animal instinct to have a relationship with a predator. And yet we do it every day.
We do.
Which is amazing. So anything else you want to add?
Nope, that's it. That was great.
All right. Thank you guys for joining us today on the paper of, and I will post in the description box below the title and author of the paper so you can look that up, print it out, read it for yourself. Lots of interesting stuff in there if you are a horse owner. And we hope you join us next time. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Be kind.
Bye.